What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
Here's to the ones who dream. Foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that ache. Here's to the mess we make.
Emma Stone in La La Land, the recipient earlier this week of a record-tying 14 Oscar nominations. This week's show devoted to the two films many consider to be the frontrunners for this year's Best Picture Oscar, director Damien Chazelle's hit musical and Moonlight, which received 8 nominations, about a boy growing up poor and gay in 1980s Miami. Reviews of both films, plus my interview with Moonlight writer-director Barry Jenkins and one of the film's stars, Oscar nominee Naomi Harris. All ahead on Film Spotting. I know we promised after the big live show that we were going to come back with our 2017 movie preview and we'd talk a little Sundance and maybe even review the new M. Night Shyamalan movie Split, which I have seen, but with Josh's Sundance schedule and my trip to LA, it just didn't prove possible. So we're going to revisit some reviews and an interview that, of course, seem very timely right now in light of those recent Oscar nominations. We will get Josh's reaction to Sundance and all the films he saw there, plus the Oscar nominations and our 2017 movie preview next week. We may, of course, talk a little bit about Split as well, and I will need that time to get over the Best Original Song snub for Sing Street and the documentary snub for my beloved Tower. First, though, let's talk Moonlight, a film that received 8 Oscar nominations and you might still say was snubbed. Trevante Rhodes is someone who certainly was deserving, as many actors were, of a Best Supporting Actor nomination. Last October, I sat down with Barry Jenkins, the film's director, who was nominated in the writing and directing categories, and one of the film's stars, supporting actress nominee Naomi Harris. For any still somehow not familiar with the movie, it's set in 1980s era Miami and is based on an autobiographical story originally meant for the stage by playwright Terrell McCraney. Jenkins and McCraney didn't know each other, but actually grew up in the same Miami neighborhood with single mothers, both of whom struggled with drug addiction. In the film, Harris plays Paula, the crack-addicted mother of the film's protagonist, Chiron, who is played at different ages by 3 different actors. If you've seen Moonlight, and if you remember this conversation, you know that one of the wonders of the film is how seamlessly those 3 performances work. I talked with Jenkins about how he went about casting those 3 very different-looking actors. Moonlight is Jenkins' second feature, following his well-received 2008 debut, Medicine for Melancholy. And Naomi Harris, a Brit, maybe best known these days as Moneypenny in a pair of recent James Bond movies, talks about what it was like to shoot all her scenes in just 3 days. Before we get to that interview, let's hear a clip from Moonlight. In this scene, Harris confronts a stranger who has brought young Chiron, nicknamed Little, home after he failed to turn up after school the previous day. The stranger, Juan, is played by Harris's fellow Oscar nominee, Mahershala Ali.
What happened? Huh? What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. Be good that way, but...
Barry, I'll start with you. Medicine for Melancholy was a movie that certainly earned some acclaim. I remember it got generally very favorable reviews, but the response to this movie, Moonlight, seems to be its own kind of whirlwind. Do you have a sense of what it is that audiences are connecting with so strongly? And is it the same thing as what drew you to the material?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really, the movie's very personal, you know, and I think people just sort of, they identify with, you know, how specifically we sort of engage Chiron's struggle, you know. And it's not this thing where what Chiron goes through is relatable to everyone. I think people see just how deep we dove into that one character, and they go, oh, you know, I wish someone could dive that deeply into me. You know, they see themselves in the character. They don't see everyone in the character. And I think in that one-to-one exchange, the movie is just spreading, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to get too personal, but what do you see in the character?
Well, you know, for Chiron, you know, I'm Naomi sitting next to me, and to be brutally honest, you know, when I first read Terrell's piece, which was written here in Chicago, actually, when he was an undergrad at DePaul, Naomi plays this character Paula, who is a composite of my mom and Terrell's mom. And so I could just relate to Chiron as a kid who was watching this person who he loves, you know, go through this just terrible ordeal.
And Naomi, speaking of your character, Paula, as viewers, we make certain assumptions and judgments mm-hmm. about her, I think, before we even meet her. If her son is so determined not to go home and to hang mm-hmm. out with these total strangers, we wonder how horrible his home life must be. Mm-hmm. When we do meet her, we recognize she may not be perfect, but she is caring and she is protective like we expect a mother to be. There's a decline from there. But how did you go about not judging this incredibly flawed character?
I didn't, I think, initially. I think that was my biggest discovery, actually, when I took on the role. I thought initially that I didn't want to play Paula. I had some resistance to playing her because I wanted to portray positive images of women and positive images of black women in particular. But actually, once I started researching the character, I really realized, I had to be honest with myself, that a lot of the resistance was about my own judgment about addiction. I'm a miscontrol freak. I'm teetotal. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't even drink coffee. So I had a real problem wrapping my head around what drives someone to have an addiction to something like crack cocaine. And it was a wonderful journey where I had to learn deep compassion. Well, first of all, understanding, and then deep empathy for Paula's choices.
Yeah. And without spoiling too much of the movie and the journey Paula goes on, did you come to see her journey as a positive one?
Absolutely. I think it's a shining example of how, you know, you can only give to others what you have received yourself. You know, if your love tank is empty because you didn't receive what you needed as a child, it's very difficult to give that to another human being. Also, another human being is who that's your child, because often your child is, you know, your child is an extension of yourself. So I think your self-loathing, and Paula has a lot of that, is taken out on your child, because when you look at them, you see yourself. So until you heal that relationship with yourself, I think it's very difficult to love another human being.
I think that really comes through in particular in one scene, kind of at her worst moment, where she says, almost in a haunting way, but also in a loving way, that you're my only and I'm yours. There is that reflection back in those characters. So what's more challenging than shooting a Bond film in Istanbul with all these action scenes, or playing someone so opposite who you really are?
I would say Bond, actually.
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
What?
Because of all the stunts. Yeah. It's they're just completely different challenges, aren't they? It's challenged in a completely different way.
Well, so I guess the more serious version of that question is, why is it important to you as an actress to take both kinds of roles, these big action spectacles, but do these smaller, more intimate movies as well?
Because I'm ultimately interested, both as a performer and as an individual, in growth and learning. I think that in life we often play one character, and actually we are made up of multiple characters that usually most people don't get to discover. And I think the joy in acting is discovering all those different parts of yourself. And that's what acting allows you to do. And if I play varied roles, then I get to exercise those parts of myself that I never knew existed.
Barry, I wanted to ask you about the influences, because I know you've gotten this question a lot at the Chicago Film Fest Q&A after the movie. You threw out the three movies that you said had the biggest influence on the style of this film: Beau Travail, Three Times, Happy Together. And I think you can definitely see those influences in the film, in the way that it's quite lyrical. It's certainly not focused on gritty realism necessarily. And the moments that, as I reflect back on it, that stand out to me in the movie are actually just those. They're moments. They're the moments that you kind of draw out or heighten or return to. They're kind of moments that, these tableau kind of moments that almost take you out of time and space. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was appropriate, because I think those are the moments we remember from our childhoods. As we reflect back, we think of those. We forget a lot, but we remember just certain images and certain sounds.
Yeah, and as a person who has, you know, kind of found their voice through creating visual storytelling, you know, through images, you know, it was something Terrell and I always discussed, this project of sort of being like a fever dream. You know, I said to him, "You've taken memories of my memories and sort of like presented them as this fever dream." And I feel like in the film, you know, I wanted the audience to experience, you know, what Chiron is experiencing. And he is almost like, he's a participant in his own life, but at some point his consciousness sort of like, you know, it sort of gets away from him, you know, and it takes on this heightened quality, mm-hmm. you know, and I wanted to find a way to translate that, you know, in a way that the audience can experience what the character is experiencing.
Yeah. And that notion of it being a fever dream, it reminds me of what Terrell said about having written this script or written this play and then realized that he couldn't really stage it. You obviously saw something cinematic in the material. What was it?
Yeah, right away. You know, it was partly because, you know, as a filmmaker, I've never made anything that was like personal in this way, by which I mean that was like at the foundation of how I grew up, where I grew up, when I grew up. And Terrell's piece gave me the opportunity to do that. And because of that, it's like a one-to-one sort of like translation. It's like, oh, I know exactly what that looks like and what that feels like. I don't need to travel, you know, 2,000 miles to Miami to know what that corner feels like. I've been there, you know, and in a beautiful way. It then took this filmmaking voice I've developed, which is absent from my home environment where I grew up. And now I can, I think film has given me a chance to speak about, you know, the way I grew up in a voice that I didn't think myself capable of, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the converse happened where now my filmmaking voice has been elevated because I know this world so viscerally.
The films that you mentioned as influences, are those films that you came to through film school and kind of later as you got into cinema, or were they some of the films that really turned you on to cinema in the first place?
You know, the two things happened at once. You know,
yeah.
I wasn't in love with cinema at all growing up. I didn't really care that much about movies. I kind of stumbled into it after I was already at Florida State doing my undergrad in creative writing. And I'm a big football fan, and there just happened to be a film school in the football stadium. That's where the film school was at Florida State. Yeah, so I was going to a football game because they rebuilt the stadium, and I think out of guilt they had to put something there that wasn't football related, and that was the film school. And so I thought, oh, I kind of like movies. I'll check this out. And I saw right away that everybody was – the movies they were watching were sort of informing their aesthetic, and I thought, I want my aesthetic to be, you know, like unique, and so I'm going to watch nothing but foreign films. And some of those films are the movies I watched as I was first falling in love with filmmaking. And I think it's not a surprise that my voice has been heavily influenced by those things. And I think the work of the last 15 years as a filmmaker has been, okay, now this is where the influence stops and this is where Barry Jenkins begins. And this project gave me just the greatest palette to express that.
Naomi, at that same Chicago Film Fest Q&A, Terrell mentioned one of the central questions in the movie being, am I a man? What kind of man am I? What defines me? Is it my sexuality, how tough I am, how I look? But I recognize, I think, that identity struggle doesn't just apply to the boys here. There's a certain expectation placed on women like Paula as women to be a certain type of mother. And there's a lot of baggage associated with that I don't know that most of us think about every day, but probably should.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really interesting question. We haven't actually...
In the form of
never heard that question. We have never gotten that question.
I apologize.
My mind is spinning. Like,
I was like, huh, that's a good question. What do you think, Naomi?
What do you think, Barry?
I think the question is getting at something that's really interesting, which is all these characters have a full life. It's like the iceberg theory from Hemingway. Because of the pace we tell the story at Chiron's iceberg, we do reveal all these things beneath the surface. It's a part of the character. He's pushing everything down. And we're like, okay, we're going to take you down there. And we want to see the rest of the iceberg. I think with a character like Paula, you know, we're not privy to those things, but I feel like it's in the performance. And I think when we meet her in that very first scene on that porch, you can see all these pressures, all these things, you know, that she has to be, both for herself and for Chiron. And it's a lot to deal with. And I think it's part of the reason why, you know, the sort of addiction overcomes her, you know. I think there's so much weight.
And I think that weight is there because actually that's a good point about mothering, because it takes a community to raise a child. And ultimately what Paula is trying to do is do it on her own because she's surrounded by so many negative influences. And on top of that, she doesn't have the personal resources to be able to do that. She hasn't had the good parenting model that she needed to be able to parent her son on top of all of that. So I think it's
And I just love that we're in a world where, and she has a boy, you know, who is not going to be embraced by everyone in the community for certain stigmas.
Yeah. And that moment that you have, really one of the most powerful scenes in the film where you have a confrontation with Juan, that's kind of the undercurrent of that that whole scene is mm-hmm. that it's very easy for him to judge and mm. suggest that you should be a certain type of mother, but he doesn't actually have the responsibility.
Yeah, I think it's partly that, and I think it's also partly because that's an example for me of how Paula has been let down by men so mm-hmm. often in her life mm-hmm. In the past that she can't accept any form of help because yeah. she's not used to having any. And if anybody does offer help, it's always because they've got an angle. They want to take something ultimately. So she's very suspicious at that point
because
yeah. she's like, what's going to come next? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want from my son?
Right. I want to ask Barry about the casting and the directing of the three actors who play the three incarnations of Chiron, Alex Hibbert, Ashton Sanders, Trevante Rhodes. But I first want to ask you, I think you're the only direct link between those three characters in terms of seeing you in all three stories. What was it like for you having to maintain some continuity emotionally and psychologically opposite those three different actors?
I mean, I didn't really find that difficult because, you know, I had to have done that research beforehand and known Paula's arc and journey and her history and so on. And I just brought that to bear in each of the chapters. But I think it really did help having Chiron played by different actors mm-hmm. because my relationship with my three sons at those in those three stages is fundamentally extraordinarily different because Paula's in such a completely different emotional state. It's not just that they've changed.
Right.
It's because she's almost, you know, she's changed dramatically in each of those chapters. So I think it helped.
I was shocked to hear you say, Barry, at that Q&A, that you didn't have those actors interact with each other, didn't watch footage of each other. It really was shocking to me just because they're not only similar in appearance, but they're similar in their physicality, in their demeanors, how they hold their heads when they're silent, which is a key part of these performances. I would have assumed exactly the opposite, that you were really meticulous about having them study each other. So how did you pull that off? Because I think it's so crucial that at the end, when we see the character Black, we have to see Little and mm-hmm. Chiron in him, and we do.
It's two words, bruh. Hocus pocus. No. You know, it's almost like Naomi was just saying, you know, so much time passes between each chapter that, you know, I think there's this commentary in the film of how the world shapes us, you know, or how we can allow the world to shape us both for good and for bad. And so I wanted to show or to illustrate in the physical embodiment of this character that the world has made him a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to cast different actors, you know, to play the same person. And I didn't want them to physically mimic one another. You know, I didn't want them to try to carry the performance that came before into their performance. Because, again, I wanted to show just how different the world can make us, how the world can shape us if we allow it. And if we don't have this nurturing, you know, that we see in the first story that isn't present in the second and the third stories. And yet at the same time, there is a continuity, you know, amongst those three young men. And I
for
think
sure.
when we were casting them, we were trying to find this feeling, you know, this soulfulness. Because I think there's this idea of spiritual transference in the film. It's why the swimming scene, you know, is the way it is. You know, there's this transference between Juan and Little in that scene. And I felt like if you could look into Trevante Rose's eyes and you could still see Ashton Sanders, still see Alex Hibbert, that you would feel like this character has changed. Yes, he's a different person, but he's still in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting because, you know, we're trying to create this journey for Trevante in the third story where the character's crawled so deep inside and buried himself so deep inside that the work Trevante is doing, aided by, you know, Andre Holland as Kevin, is to slowly dig his way back out to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do that, I thought it would be best, you know, to literally have the character embodied by a different person.
Yeah. How confident were you in your decision to not have them mirror each other at all? Did you ever have doubts about that?
Yeah. You know, so you know, we shot the movie mostly in sequence. You know, we did story one, story two, story three. The only overlap was when Naomi showed up because she had visa issues. We did all her work in 3 days. But other than that, that was the only time those 3 days when the main characters jumped. You know, I had to work with all of them. So Trevante shows up and does his first 2 days. And because of the way the shoot was scheduled, his first 2 days, I mean, in Trevante Rhodes, this is radio, I'll say, he is this just hulking, you know, like, you know, 5'11", 220-pound guy, like 2%, 1% body fat, just like ripped.
Yeah.
And his first 2 days, he's walking around in his boxers, like working out, and he's like, you know, on the phone and counting money. And it was like really jarring departure from this rail thin teenager, you know, that we worked with before, which was Ashton Sanders, whose shoulders are always drooped. And
right.
He's always like kind of sad and brooding. And I thought, man, did we go too far? because it was so jarring going from working with Ashton to working with Trevante. And then we did the phone call where Trevante call or Kevin calls and Black picks up the phone.
Yeah.
And it's just Trevante in the room and Andre Holland's voice is actually on the phone. And I can see Trevante just breaking and just so this huge hulking guy so sensitive and vulnerable. And after the first take, I looked at him. I said, that's why you got the part.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, we're on the right track.
Certainly.
But for those that day and a half, I was like, oh, man. But then I sit in the audience and I see the audience have the same reaction. He comes on screen and sometimes the audience will go,
yeah.
Like literally, it takes their breath away because they gasp.
Yeah,
this is what the world has done to this guy. Mm-hmm. You know.
But then when we see him at the diner sitting across from Kevin, and we see Chiron in him in those moments, then I think we gasp again.
Well, and the beauty of this process is, you know, I can only write this thing and get the actors in place and push the button, and then an intellectual idea, you know, a scripted idea. You know, it's given this flesh and blood emotion when somebody like Trevante can actually express that vulnerability and that sensibility that we don't associate or we don't think someone who's that masculine is capable of.
Just two more quick questions and I'll get you guys on your way. Naomi, the mention there of doing this whole role in just 3 days, is there any advantage at all to having to work that quickly as an actress?
There are many, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because you don't spend hours in your trailer agonizing about what you're going to do, plotting it out in your head. You know, you just have to get on and deliver. And the best place to be always is out of your head.
Mm-hmm.
But the place you always want to go to is your head.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it actually really helped me doing it in those 3 days.
Barry, last question for you then. A film school, film geek question, because we have a lot of them who listen to the show, people who are just really getting into film or who are aspiring filmmakers. At that Q&A, you mentioned Walter Murch and In the Blink of an Eye, and that's a book that whenever people write into the show and ask me to recommend books, I read that in film school. It's one of my top five, I always say. Nice. But can you just talk about the influence of that book on your visual approach with this film or any other work that you've done, and what other books do you throw out when you get asked that question?
Yeah, the only other book I throw out is a book called Masters of Light, you know, and I would say find the original version. It was this book with a really thick book, thin paper, thick book. They interviewed cinematographers about their process, and it's really, really dense. But it will teach you, if you pay attention, some really solid things about the visual approach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean craft to the process, how craft can be elevated or sublimated into art. So that book is the only other one I recommend. As far as Murch, you know, Walter Murch was an editor and sound designer. He worked with Coppola on some of his some of the greatest films in the history of American cinema. And he wrote this book as a thesis statement on what he thought, you know, was the true essence of craft in cinema, which was the eyes of the actors. And the eyes being the window into the soul. And literally, he wanted to break down why editorially, when you make a cut, you know, what that does thematically, emotionally to the audience, because you're breaking the link between, you know, the actor and the audience. So for me, I use it for casting, because if I'm close on two actors and they're pretty much neck and neck, you know, the same ability, whoever blinks the less, they're getting the part, you know? And it came into play a little bit on the casting of this
film. The old Michael Caine acting school trick as well.
Yeah, exactly. And because you want to have that continuum.
Sure.
That continuous feeling with the audience. And then, like I said, you know, I knew I wanted to cast three different actors to play Chiron in this film. And what we found ourselves honing in on was, it's got to be in the eyes. You know, it was why casting someone like Trevante Rhodes, I was okay with it, or I was comfortable with it, because I thought he looks so different than Ashton, you know, just because he's so bulked up.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know what, I'm going to have faith in this principle now of my filmmaking process, which is the eyes are the window into the soul. Find the eyes and you'll see the soul. And if the soul is the same, the audience will follow the character.
Thank you both so much for the movie. Thank you for your time and best of luck with it.
Thank you, man.
You're my only. I'm your only. No. You gon' listen.
To who, Ma? Huh? To you?
Who is you, man? I ain't seen you in like a decade. It's not what I expected.
What did you expect?
My My thanks again to Barry Jenkins and Naomi Harris. I knew they would be a delight to talk to after hearing them talk for a little bit at that FilmFest Q&A the night before, but they exceeded my expectations, and I was the last stop on their way out of town. I knew they had been locked up in a hotel room all day answering questions from idiots like me, and then they were stopping to see me at the studio and head out. And usually that can mean sometimes they're a little tired and maybe not quite as engaged as even they'd like to be and I'd like them to be. That certainly wasn't the case with them.
I'm really glad that Jenkins brought up cinematography there at the end and mentioned the book Masters of Light, where Dennis Schaefer and Larry Salvato, they have conversations with some of the most noted cinematographers. And Jenkins' comment, too, about how the book explains how cinematography can be a craft that can be elevated to art, mm-hmm. because that is exactly what my takeaway was from Moonlight, is watching that actually happen on the screen. This is just a masterwork in cinematography, and Jenkins was working here with James Laxton as his cinematographer. And really, it's not only that the movie is beautifully lit, but it's that the skin tones, particularly the African-American skin tones, are just exquisitely lit in this movie. And I single that out because it's not always the case. Mm-hmm. Even when you're talking about, you know, big Hollywood films with massive budgets, sometimes they don't know how to light all of the actors correctly. And this connects very much with what I think Moonlight is doing on a thematic level as well. There is just this aura of compassion that seeps down from the movie. And obviously, they're getting this a little bit by the reference that the title pulls mm-hmm. from, you know, the illumination of the moon. That's a guiding light in a couple of ways for this film, but it really carries through no matter whether they're in, you know, a dark night scene or whether they're in one of the high school classrooms mm-hmm. where there's fluorescent lights or wherever they may be. There is such care to make these varied skin tones illuminate, and you can see the texture and the detail. And I think that carries over again to how the movie sees Chiron, how it sees really all of its characters, but particularly him, in just giving this sort of beneficent hue that makes us just fall in love with this kid
yeah.
and ache for him, really ache for him in a way that few movies manage to make audiences do.
Yeah, you mentioned the reference there in the title, Moonlight, and it does come up within the text there of the screenplay, but the story that McCraney originally wrote, the piece he originally wrote that he couldn't stage, is called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And that is such a brilliantly striking central metaphor, like I said, that does come up in this movie because it sets up exactly what this whole film is about, but in a pretty subtle way, mm-hmm. which is that other people are always going to try to define you. They are going to see you how they see you within a certain moment, and you may not be able to escape the way they see you. It is ultimately on you to define yourself. And as simplistic as that might be, there's nothing simple about this film or about the performances. And one of the things that I was really glad Barry Jenkins said in my conversation there in praise of Harris, he mentioned how we're not privy to a lot of information about her, but it comes through in her performance. And that's so true. And that must be so hard for any actor or actress to pull off. But I felt like I knew her entire backstory. I understood her relationship with men. I understood her problems as a mother raising this boy just from the performance. No flashbacks, no other dialogue to spell it out. It really does all come through in the experience of watching the performance.
And she does have the benefit, as you mentioned in the interview, of appearing in each of the three sections. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't have a huge part in each of those, but she does appear and makes a large impact in those scenes that she has. But really, every actor we see manages to make the most of their time on screen. And there's
Without
a continuity,
doubt.
As you guys talked about, among the three actors playing Chiron and how they manage to capture things that are similar in each mm-hmm. section, but also make him distinct in each section. I think the through line, again, is the cinematography. When we see him in the same literal light, we connect him
yeah.
as being the same person. But I also want to take time to praise Mahershala Ali because that was the performance that I don't know why just and it's devastating when he disappears from the narrative.
Yes.
And you feel that absence in the other segments that he's not in because he makes such an impact in that first segment. And not because he gets any grandstanding scene. Mm-hmm. He's almost in the background, so quiet as this drug dealer who takes young Little under his wings. And at first, he's almost, you wonder, is this a wolf in sheep's clothing? We're trained by other movies, right? More than anything else to think this is a bad situation.
He doesn't tip his hand either way.
No, he does not. I mean, you still get a sense that maybe this could go wrong near the end, even after you've seen him and really feel that his protection is genuine. There's that gorgeous scene where he takes Little swimming and teaches him how to swim. And I think that's where we finally begin to understand that his interest is genuine in the boy. But just the way Ali makes these quiet moments hit so hard, again, without pushing any sort of demonstrative personality, you would think as this drug dealer who runs the block, the temptation would be to go big, right? But no, it's just his quiet presence, and it's really one of my favorite performances of the year.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I think that gets back to what I was saying about Harris as well, where she's playing the crack-addicted, negligent mother. We've seen a character like her in plenty of films. We've seen a character like Ali's playing Juan in a lot of films, that drug dealer, even the drug dealer with a heart of gold, which...
Sure.
He is more or less as we get to know him. But there isn't anything cliche at all about these characters as it comes through in these performances. And Ali's one of those faces where as soon as I saw him on screen, I felt comfortable. I knew I had seen him before. Recently, I looked up IMDb later, and he's been in a bunch of things, but recently in the Hunger Games movies.
Right.
And that's where I did have his face in my mind. But what about Andre Holland?
Andre Holland,
who plays Kevin... He's
talk about
he's
making
in that
the most of
piece.
Your scenes.
Yeah, that third act of this film. And he's someone, again, I'm watching him going, not only is he remarkable, I could watch him and Ali in their scenes. Just give me a movie that's just those
their
guys.
Their stories, yeah.
I would so watch those films. I'd watch multiple films with those guys. But he was another face that seemed really familiar to me, and I couldn't place it. And then I looked up later, he was in The Nick, the Steven Soderbergh series. And he's another wonderful actor. And I wanted to re-mention the three titles that came up in the interview that Jenkins listed as the biggest influences on this film, because some people may not be familiar with them, or maybe they just went by too fast and they didn't catch the titles. But you talk about cinematography and the craft of that and how that's art. Not a surprise that those elements would come through in this film when those influences were Claire Denis' film, Beau Travail, Ho Shao Shen's Three Times, and then Wong Kar Wai's Happy Together. Now, have you seen Happy Together?
Haven't. Days of Being Wild was the last one I caught up with.
So that's a Wong Kar Wai film I regretfully haven't seen either, but a friend of mine who loves that film and who was at the same Moonlight screening I was and who loved Moonlight said that there's definitely some Wong Kar Wai Happy Together touches there, especially in that third sequence with Trevante Rhodes and Andre Holland. We meet Andre Holland's character first through a phone conversation he's having. We hear his voice and we only see parts of him as he's a cook. He's in a kitchen. We don't actually see his face for a while. And my friend said that that is really something that is mirrored actually in the Wong Kar-wai film. So I did want to mention that for people who love that film as well. A couple other things that came out of the Q&A after the screening that I thought were really fascinating. I just wanted to throw out there. Terrell Alvin McCraney, the playwright and writer of the original piece, was part of the Q&A, and he said something that I don't know that I would have been able to articulate at all, but absolutely felt in every moment of that third act with those actors, those grown-up versions of these characters we've met earlier in the film. He talks about how there's heightened tension and a sense of urgency in there because of the fact that they are what he termed real minutes. And what he was articulating, or what I took away from it, is that he was saying, when you're watching this film that starts with one version of this character in the past, and then we go to another version and we realize that he's older, we know we're watching this construct where we're very aware that this happened in another place and time. And it's almost like it's not really happening now. And when we get to that version of him right now, in the present day, these two characters meet again. Now we know that we're watching them starting a whole new trajectory, and we have no idea where it's going to go. It's where their lives in some way begin for us as viewers, and we have to fill in the blanks. And there is something inherently fascinating about that that does raise the stakes of two people mostly just talking.
Real minutes, was that the phrase?
Real minutes. Used?
Yeah. That's my impression while I was watching it, is what incredible patience on the part of Jenkins to allow this reunion to spread out in what almost feels like real time. There's the phone call to set it up. And then when Sharon, who's now goes by the name Black, shows up at the restaurant to meet with Kevin, he first says hello, and then Kevin goes to serve some other people. Just minute, boring things that I won't go on to describe, except to say that it extends the scene so that it's not that all we get are their conversation together. And even their conversation is interrupted by Kevin having to go do some more work. And that does exactly what you're talking about. It breaks up the pattern of what we've seen before, where they're not vignettes. They're not episodes. We're here with these two in the right now, and that lends it so much more drama.
Yeah, the other part, and this is something I certainly wouldn't have been aware of had Jenkins not expressed it and described it in answer to a question someone in the audience who was aware of this style of music, but what he did with the score here and the music as well, it really comes through in that third sequence. But you reflect back on how some of the more traditional movie score sounds are rendered in this film, where they seem distorted in some way. They seem like they are perfectly in keeping with this notion of a kind of heightened fever dream, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't understand exactly what was being done to the sounds to manipulate them, to make them have that distorted, heightened effect. And what he described is the style of music that came out of Houston in the early 90s, mainly called Chopped and Screwed. And it's where you take hip-hop and you remix it so that everything is slowed way down, and it does have that distorting kind of effect. So we hear that in the songs that are playing in Black's car really the whole time that we are with him. But then you realize that even the oboes and the other strings and things that you're hearing in earlier portions of the film, they have that same technique applied to them to give it that effect.
Yeah, and it's just the use of those classical music instruments altogether where you might not expect it. In the early segment where the boys are just out on the field, you know, roughhousing and wrestling and messing around, we get this lyrical music to it that makes it suddenly seem as if it's something from a Malick film. And I believe the same sort of music accompanies that swimming scene, which is some sort of, you know, baptism moment taking place. And so these are other uses of the usual cinematic techniques in ways that maybe we've seen here or there, but not always applied to a story like this.
Moonlight is still playing in limited release in about 400 theaters nationwide. Its digital release is scheduled for February 7th, with DVD to follow on the 28th. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Moonlight may be the single film with a shot at upsetting the Best Picture frontrunner, 14-time nominee La La Land. Josh and I reviewed La La back in early December before many had a chance to see it. We revisit that review next. Stay with us.
If any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
The great writer and intellectual James Baldwin, in a clip from the new Oscar-nominated documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, director Raoul Peck's meditation on what it means to be black in America, which works from the text of Baldwin's unfinished final novel. For our Chicago area listeners, we have a chance to win Admit 2 passes to see I Am Not Your Negro during its run at the AMC River East. It opens on February 6th. You can do that now. Enter to get those passes at filmspotting.net. Also on our site, you can participate in the current Film Spotting poll. It is a most anticipated of 2017 deathmatch between Christopher Nolan's World War II epic Dunkirk and Blade Runner 2049 from Arrival director Denis Villeneuve. It stars Ryan Gosling and who else? Harrison Ford. It's a very, very close battle, as you would expect any good deathmatch to be. We hope you will participate at filmspotting.net. And then we have the Luis Buñuel Marathon. Remember that? We do. Very excited to be diving back into the work of Buñuel, presented by our friends at MUBI. We're currently 4 films into our planned 7-film marathon. We had to take a break for all the year-end madness. We will get to the 5th film next week, and then we're going to knock these out one every week until we are finished and until we move on to our next marathon, which we do already have planned, and we're very excited about. We'll have the details about that soon. But next week's film is going to be Diary of a Chambermaid, starring the wonderful Jean Moreau. And now, speaking of year-end madness, let's get to a film many have gone mad for and others have gotten mad at for various reasons, La La Land. Damien Chazelle's old-school live-action musical starring Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling is a hit with audiences and earlier this week received a record-tying 14 Oscar noms, including noms for Stone, Gosling, and Chazelle in both the writing and directing categories. When Josh and I reviewed the film back in early December, it hadn't yet opened here in Chicago, so with so many having caught up with it since then, we thought it might be worth revisiting. I know I still need to revisit the movie for the second time, seeing it on the big screen as I hope to, and seeing if some of my reservations about it on the initial viewing and as I considered it for my top 10 of the year and almost considered bumping it out of the top 10 of the year still hold, or if in fact I will be swept away with it like Josh has. It was his number 5 film of the year and so many others. Here's our take from December.
I just heard you play and I wanted... It's pretty strange that we keep running into each other.
Maybe it means something.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't think so. You could just write your own roles, you know, write something that's as interesting as you are.
What are you gonna do?
I have my own club.
Is that gonna happen every time?
I think so.
How are you going to be a revolutionary if you're such a traditionalist? You're holding on to the past, but jazz is about the future.
Maybe I'm not good enough.
Yes, you are.
Maybe I'm not. It's like a pipe dream.
This is the dream. It's conflict and it's compromise. It's very, very exciting.
As you know, Adam, at home, as a family, we've been chronologically working our way through the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers filmography. In fact, all we have left is their last film together, 1949's The Barclays of Broadway. We didn't plan to wrap this up right around the time that La La Land would be out, but I'm so glad that it worked out that way. There are a lot of influences on Damien Chazelle's contemporary musical, in which Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling sing and dance as Hollywood dreamers pursuing their passions, and that includes each other. Given the movies that I've been watching lately, however, I couldn't help but notice the similarities to those Astaire-Rogers pictures. Nothing I've seen in recent decades, not the Baz Luhrmann spectaculars, not the John Carney heart-tuggers, certainly not the Rob Marshall revivals, have so wondrously captured, as La La Land does, the fizzy joy, the tender-heartedness, and the good old-fashioned showmanship of Astaire and Rogers. Suffice it to say, then, La La Land was a glorious thrill for me, and I can't wait to discuss the music, the choreography, the costuming, and perhaps my favorite element, the lighting. I suppose we should consider some of the critiques that might come the movie's way. Maybe that Stone and Gosling play stock characters. Maybe that Chazelle's camera is overactive. Maybe that there's a lull in the third act. But I have to say, La La Land is a movie that made me so happy that I won't be able to offer much more than a smile and a shrug in the face of such criticisms. In fact, Adam, if you're going to surprise me and say you actively didn't care for the movie, I'll probably just tune out and start humming City of Stars, one of its signature songs, in my head. So please, please tell me you plan only to sing La La Land's praises.
Well, I'm definitely not going to rain all over your Easter parade, Josh, so you don't have to worry about that. It is funny that you mention some of the criticisms that could come this movie's way. I haven't read any of those. I can see those, though they don't apply for me at all, but I will bite. I'll take your challenge. Let's start with maybe a couple things that didn't completely work for me or I'm still wrestling with a little bit as I consider the film, and we'll see if you agree with me at all. Stone and Gosling, I love them as actors, and they are the perfect performers, I think, to play these roles, and they play them wonderfully. And of course, they're helped by the script, by the choreography, by the cinematography, by the production design. Everything that's happening on screen is all in their favor as a couple, as a romantic couple. And I think, if my math is correct, and if I'm remembering these movies correctly, though Gangster Squad's certainly forgettable, I think this is the third time, at least now, they've played lovers on screen together. But for me, there were times watching this film, Josh, where I perceived them as almost to have more of a big brother, little sister type of a relationship. And I think it's just my relationship to them as actors in the public sphere. They're kind of both America's sweethearts. And so I think that's probably my failing as opposed to theirs or anything the movie is doing. But I think I might enjoy them better in this movie or any movie if they were just playing brother and sister or best friends. For example, the banter that they have in many scenes, but especially in one of their early scenes in this film where they're at a party together. They don't know that they're both going to be there. They keep meeting, and she embarrasses him as he's playing Flock of Seagulls in an 80s cover band.
All right. I remember you. And I'll admit I was a little curt that night.
Curt?
Okay, I was an ass. I can admit that.
Okay.
But requesting Iran from a serious musician is just, it's too far.
My lord, did you just say a serious musician?
I don't think so.
Can I borrow what you're wearing?
Why?
Because I have an audition next week. I'm playing a serious firefighter.
So you're an actress. I thought you looked familiar. Have I seen you in anything?
That banter they have after that, where they're riffing with each other, for me is almost as much fun to watch as any of the musical numbers in the film. So it works when those two are just in a platonic relationship versus when they are actually really courting each other, which obviously we get later in this film. So that's one issue I'll throw out there. The other one is, I love how, and credit to Ryan Gosling, all hail Ryan Gosling, the coolest, best-looking guy in any room he walks into, a great dramatic actor, I've come to realize, a great comedic actor, and of course, he can sing and dance too. There's really nothing this guy can't do. And I believe that he had some piano background already. And if he didn't, or if he only had minimal amount, they taught him more and he learned it for this film, because they do pull off that trick of usually showing him playing the piano, as opposed to when he's doing these intricate jazz riffs, they're not just showing hands all the time or shooting from over his shoulder or where the piano's in the way and you can't see him. It looks like he's playing. And I love the fact that in a film where his musicianship is so vital to who he is, his professionalism as a musician is so vital to who he is, we believe him as that professional musician. We don't ever really get that equally with Emma Stone's Mia. She's
really?
An actress. No, she goes on lots of auditions. She, much to her chagrin, gets interrupted a lot, or she's just ignored. And sometimes the writing is just so horrible in these scenes that she really shouldn't be coming off as a good actress. But even when she does start to develop a voice where she's written something for herself, we cut from her going out on stage to then the disappointment of the end of that performance. And we don't ever actually get to see her perform any of those scenes she's written for herself, nor do we actually get to hear any of those words. Even when she writes the first draft of it, all we get is this quick cut and he's saying to her, it's amazing.
Right.
You're great. And I just wish that we had that balance a little bit.
Well, I think that's, you know, a wise choice, because first of all, this one woman play she writes sounds horrible.
Yeah. And I wonder if
that's part of the point.
Partly what's suggested.
It's not so much that she's creating a masterpiece. It's that she's expressing herself and going after her artistic vision. I would actually say there are two instances, and you referenced them, where we see her being a talent as well, and it's the audition scenes. It's, you know, terrible dialogue.
But she rarely gets through one.
Well, but it doesn't matter. When we first see her, her first audition in probably the first 10 minutes of the film, she does get interrupted, but she's selling that scene, and the camera's close up on her face, and it becomes really emotional. And yes, then it backs away. She gets interrupted. Someone knocks on the door, and then we're shown how her life as an aspiring actress is. So that's one where we get a hint that I think she really nails that audition. Then we get the big showstopper, where she has
much
an audition
later in the film
to a great song. That one is one of the Justin Hurwitz songs that have been composed for the picture. It's Audition, The Fools Who Dream. And wow, does she – I mean, I think this is Stone's movie, even though it's very egalitarian. And that's one of the things I liked about it in terms of balancing their stories.
Yeah.
I think this is her movie in terms of her voice is much stronger. I think she gets those scenes of more traditional acting, whereas his is more music oriented.
True.
And she just, it makes me wish she would only do musicals from now on, basically. That would
so
be
good.
Wonderful. She's
just natural talent.
So I guess I found a little bit more of a balance there and was happy that this didn't become just his story,
mm-hmm.
Which maybe is one traditional element of old Hollywood that the movie manages to update in a good way. But the other thing that you had brought up as far as the brother-sister style relationship, I think that's very much a traditional touch from some of these older films because this is a really chaste movie.
Yeah.
We were talking about, a little earlier, like we wish we had watched this with some of our kids because I didn't know much about mm-hmm. it. And so just put it in and I'm halfway through thinking they would love this. So this is a chaste relationship in the style of old Hollywood. And a lot of those films, not just the Astaire Rogers ones, but definitely those start with a prickly duo who
right.
don't really like each other. And that's pretty much the plot is how one of mm-hmm. them, usually the male, will win over the woman. And so in a way, this is really simple.
No, you're right.
And that could maybe be another detraction from it, especially those of us contemporary audiences who are used to it being all about fully realized flesh and blood characters and their emotions. What was so enthralling to me about La La Land is that I felt all that, but I didn't feel it because of what happened plot-wise to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it because of the colors that were on
right.
screen, the music itself, of course, the gestures that they would make, whether it's Gosling shuffling his feet or Stone twirling her dress mm-hmm. in a certain way. These are the sort of cinematic elements that we've lost in pushing movie musicals aside in favor of other forms. And it was just a pure rush to see them come back and be used so well.
I agree with you. I think you make a really good point, too, when you compare this to some of those Astaire Rogers musicals or when you compare them to other musicals that are similarly chaste. When I think of those films that I've seen, I don't think about any heat really
coming. No, there isn't usually a lot of heat.
That said, those films really are, I think, more comedic and more about the entertainment value and less serious and less dramatic and less about the romance than this film is about. I think that this film really does get into some territory where we, as an audience, are rooting for them to be together beyond just the conventions of the plot. I think the movie is asking that of us, and I think it mostly pulls it off. That's probably the only musicals reference, though, you're going to get from me during this conversation. I haven't been honing my musical chops as you've been with your family, and there haven't been a ton of musicals discussion on this show, though Cabaret, we referenced earlier in the show, was part of a musicals marathon that happened, I think, in the first year of Film Spotting because Sam and I recognized that it was a real blind spot as a genre for us. Where I'm going with this, Josh, is I don't know if you've noticed this following our friend Peter Labuza on Twitter, but he has a tweet that he has had pinned to his profile for at least a couple of years. It's from 2014. And really, he'll probably say nothing else as pithy and wise as this. Sorry, Peter. Less movies about the magic of movies, more movies that are just magic. And it is a great line. And I think the sentiment has some validity. And he may chime in here and completely contradict me when I say, I think La La Land is mostly that movie. I wasn't watching this. And again, this may come back to my ignorance of the genre, having only seen maybe 5 to 10 really good Hollywood musicals. But as I watched this film, I was never thinking about the exhilarating power of cinema. I was thinking about the exhilarating power of this piece of cinema. I was caught up in this story. I wasn't thinking about Astaire and Rogers, though Emma Stone has that kind of girl next door thing that Ginger Rogers had. That did maybe pop into my head at one point. But otherwise, I certainly wasn't putting together any blatant references that Chazelle was maybe trying to make. I wasn't thinking about homages. I was viewing this film as its own unique musical. And many other people, including we'll hear from Michael Phillips later, maybe that's impossible for him. And in fact, one of the real thrills of the movie, the real delights, is seeing it within the framework of those films that have come before. But I'll give you one example of the way this film diverged for me in a really interesting way, which is right from the very beginning. You recognize, I say the very beginning, maybe not the opening number. We'll come back to that. But the next number where we see Emma Stone's character singing with her roommates as they're about to go to a party, and then especially in Sebastian, Ryan Gosling's first number, and then when they come together and they're walking to their car after being at a party together, I noticed how quiet and how melancholy the performances are. They're not playing to the back of the house the way I think of performers when I think about those musicals from the 50s. And I had to actually kind of recalibrate my expectations a little bit, where it really it forces you to pay attention. It draws you in to what they're saying, to what they're singing. It's not about maybe a film like West Side Story, where we get these exuberant outpourings of emotion in these moments. It just sort of comes out naturally. It comes out organically on the heels of whatever they just said in a way that I just found really interesting compared to some of those films that I have seen.
So I'm usually very sympathetic to Peter's sentiment. I'm resistant to movies about mm-hmm. movies, whether they're Hollywood classics or the filmmaking process. I can be suspicious, but I don't know what's happened to me this year. La La Land, I'm in the bag for, and Hail Caesar does something very similar, and it's going to be high up on my top 10 list.
I don't know if
I've changed or it's these particular movies. Let me make the case that here it is this particular movie. It does both. I mm-hmm. mean, it's luxuriating in old Hollywood musicals and can be and was a joy for me on that end. But I think it is also doing some things on its own that do express that sort of magic, the pure magic that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that these are people in Hollywood. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's the lighting that I referenced. I don't know how, and I'm sure other films have done this to some degree, but here it's used so strikingly. It's almost like responsive lighting. It's as if this whole movie is a mood ring and it will change and glow, sometimes different colors, to echo how the characters are feeling. And so early on, we get a scene where Mia walks into this restaurant where Sebastian is playing the piano, and she's been drawn in there by his music. And when she sees him playing, everything in the room dims around her, and she stands there transfixed and strikes this transfixing image mm-hmm. as she stands there. And then there's sort of a reverse where he is supposed to be playing only Christmas Chestnuts, and he rebels and starts playing one of his songs. And again, the lights dim mm-hmm. and we get a focus on him as he gets lost.
Yeah.
He gets lost in his piece. The movie really does this throughout. And like I said, sometimes it employs different colors, and it's almost the film is just alive in a way that it's like this sentient being that not all movies are. And it's that sort of response of this, that sort of tactile connection to these characters that makes it so emotionally involving to me, even though it's a very familiar, maybe even trite story.
No, you're absolutely right. The lighting is so key here. The use of color, period, in terms of the production design. And that applies to the opening scene of this film as well, which I think we have to talk about in some detail. Of course, it's going to draw attention because it's a musical number on the crowded, jammed expressway in L.A. And it's one unbroken take, though. I think you can probably see where they hid the cuts.
A few swish pans.
There. Yeah, there are a few, but it plays out like a long, unbroken take. And the combination of the intricacy of the choreography between all the cars and the dancers and the singers and how long it goes on is remarkable. But beyond the technical achievement of it, I just love a few things about it. One of them is I do love this idea of these flights of fancy that these characters have, and then the way they just go back to the grind.
Yeah.
You know, and that does strike me as what movies kind of function as anyway, right, where we get to escape into the theater.
It can be these little diversions.
For a couple hours, but then we get back in our car and we're dealing with traffic again and the horns and everything else. So that works on that level. But then right from that opening panning shot, we see this row of cars, and every single car is different in color. It becomes this kaleidoscopic sort of scene that matches, for example, the dresses of the girls
when they start getting out of the cars after that,
and so many other elements in the production design that we see after that. The other thing I really liked about it, though, is the way for the first at least 30 seconds, maybe a minute or more of the scene, I didn't time it out, but you get the sense that they could be on a set and maybe even should be on a set, because you're not seeing the rest of the world. You're seeing cars, and you're seeing people get out of cars, and you're seeing dancers. And I'm thinking about, as I'm watching it, even though I'm caught up in it, I'm thinking about how they're pulling it off. And you wonder, well, there's no way they're really shooting this in L.A. Mm-hmm. on these expressways. It has to be a set somewhere that they've managed to really look like it is Los Angeles. And then by the time we get to the end of the scene, you really have pulled back and it opens up to the whole expanse of the environment. So Chazelle manages to ground it and manages to show us that this is real, quote unquote, with these characters kind of imposing their fantasy on top of it. I think that sets up the whole film.
Your comment about them getting back to the grind, it's also perfectly capturing LA. Yes, there's a whole other, you know, business side to LA that has nothing to do with the entertainment industry. But still, just when we lived there for a few months and you saw everyone by the pool had a script next to them,
right?
There is that element of everyone in their car may be on the way to an audition. And so they do join in this song, get caught up in the exuberance of just show business and performing. And that's what they're sharing there for that little moment. And it again also opens up to make this story universal for people who've had any sort of aspirations, which these two characters are stand-ins for. And that's why this is going to be, you know, I hope a theater lover's delight. Kids who want to get into theater will just eat this up. I can't wait for this to get out to audiences, basically. Now, you mentioned how the songs have a melancholy tinge, and I think you're right about that. The ones that I remember most, like City of Stars, work that way. Those are the ones I've been humming. But there is another big show-stopping back-of-the-house number, and that's at the Griffith Observatory. And I want to get your take on that one, because it really blows things up pretty wide to the point where I was wondering if this is a misguided attempt to recreate the ballet of the Red Shoes in the Red Shoes, you know, the Paul Pressburger musical. And it seemed a little out of sync, perhaps, or overly ambitious with what else has been going on in the film.
Maybe. I can see it as a bit of a departure, but I didn't have that reaction to it. Somehow it felt perfectly in keeping with this film that at any moment something like that could happen. And I think to your point about how fizzy this film is, and I like that word, the movie I was actually thinking about most while I watched this film wasn't any of the old musicals. As I said, it was another film from this year, The Neon Demon.
Oh, right? Really?
You want to compare and contrast the struggles of a young actress slash model in Hollywood trying to make their way and everybody
Demon,
being in the business.
Not chased.
Not chased at all, but think about it. This is a film, I'm not spoiling anything here about The Neon Demon, which I know is out there now, I think, on various platforms if you haven't caught up with it. That's a film that features necrophilia and witches, and yet it's more realistic than La La Land. I think it actually has a firmer grasp on...
Speak for your own Hollywood experiences, Adam.
Hey, you know, maybe I've watched too much David Lynch, but that's how I imagine it. So there is an element to this film, without a doubt, that says you have to embrace that old school approach where Hollywood certainly, when they made these kind of films, what they were trying to do largely was not just sell movie tickets, but sell the American public on the myth of Hollywood. And that's what keeps them coming back to the theater, is the more they buy into that myth and they buy into these stars. And this film does certainly feel at home within that scheme.
So does that mean if The Neon Demon makes my top 10 list, I'm going to have three this year? About the magic of movies?
Yeah. Is that about the magic of movies?
I think I better retire.
That's an interesting take on The Neon Demon. But one other thing I did want to praise about this film is the way it finally does introduce some conflict. And there is maybe an element where, going back to these kind of traditional Hollywood plots, it is based on sort of a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And again, that feels right. A convenient misunderstanding. Somehow it does feel right, even if it's something in another film we might be more critical of. But that part aside, you know there is going to be some conflict in this film. For the first hour or so, everything is La La Land. It is this fizzy fantasy. It is following them as they're struggling a little bit to find who they really are in Hollywood, but their romantic relationship couldn't be going better. You know at some point, something's going to have to cause a rift because, as I've said, there's really no drama otherwise, and it's preordained pretty much from the moment they see each other early in the film. Well, maybe not the initial moment, but as they keep meeting each other, and even as they sing a song to each other that says, "You're not working on me, we don't have a future," you know that it's preordained they're going to get together. So what is going to be the conflict? I'm not going to spoil anything. I will say that I give Chazelle as a screenwriter a lot of credit because I was waiting for it. I was wondering how it was going to happen, and I bought it. I really bought when that conflict finally does arise and why. And it isn't about a lack of love in their relationship. It isn't about them being totally selfish individuals. It's just them being flawed human beings. One of the thoughts I had watching this film was that it does on some level remind you that not just Hollywood people trying to achieve their dream and having those individual ambitions, anybody in a relationship, they're kind of miracles that they happen at all, that people give themselves over to another person in that way. I think by the time you get to the end of this film, that is one of the themes, actually, of the movie.
I only wish that the moment of conflict had been another musical number. And maybe this is a compliment to Hurwitz that I just wanted more. But it's, see, it's mostly a conversation.
Yeah, but that's what I love about it. Because, Josh, in that scene, that's where the fantasy crumbles. And it crumbles because we finally see that there are some cracks in the relationship.
Sure.
And that's amplified by the fact that they're just talking about it. The color is completely...
Yeah, the color is good. The use of color I like there.
That scene at the table where they're having dinner, and there's no more music. There's no more like song. There's a little bit of something on in the background.
Yeah, they're playing a record. There's almost a little green, like, hint there.
Yeah.
That does fit.
This
I
is
guess.
How you know something is... Something has turned. It's in the lighting. It's in the fact that they're not singing. I
maybe
think that's crucial.
Maybe my difficulty was that they're asked to do a different sort of performing there mm-hmm. that,
but I
yes,
think
is different
great.
For a purpose.
I think they're great in that scene.
I don't think that's quite as strong. But I do like the twist that he gives in terms of the final resolution and where – and this is very –
And we're not going to spoil
non-traditional. No,
I promise,
no, I'm not going to spoil it.
Because I would refuse to do that.
I will just say that it's very non-traditional. This is a departure from what you might expect.
Yes.
In a way that I think is, we shouldn't say anything more, but I appreciate
it. Here's how I'm going to say it without giving anything away. The last 10, maybe 15 minutes of this movie, the way it does ultimately conclude, if it didn't do that, if it didn't play out the way it did, if it didn't take us on the journey it takes us on, I really would have appreciated this film and I really would have recommended it for all the reasons we've talked about. It would not have hit me on a real emotional level or on any kind of poignant gut level if it wasn't for how the movie ultimately surprises me.
Yeah.
The way it does.
I'd agree. It's that element of surprise where the familiarity is what I was enjoying so much through the entire running time, but it was nice to have that little surprise.
La La Land is currently playing in wide release and will likely only go wider in light of its Oscar nominations haul. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our thoughts, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We do have one more bit of Oscar-related content for you. Some Arrival talk that originally aired back in December as well. It is heavy on spoilers. I mean, it's a complete spoiler take on the movie. So if you've seen the Best Picture nominee and still have some questions, as many have, wait for the credits to roll on this episode and take a listen. Arrival makes it to DVD on Valentine's Day. Its digital release is scheduled for January 31st. Basically, we thought that this was a good conversation. We've had a lot of people write in who heard it and say they found it helpful as they were trying to unpack that film. And we thought we would just try to give it a little bit more exposure here if you missed it or if you've now caught up with the movie since then. Out in wide release this weekend, Gold, starring Matthew McConaughey, Resident Evil, The Final Chapter, and A Dog's Purpose with Dennis Quaid and, I'm guessing, some doggies. In limited release here in Chicago, Asghar Farhadi's Best Foreign Language Film nominated The Salesman. Can't wait to see that. Next week, Josh is back from Sundance, and we're back with a new show, part one of our 2017 preview. We'll share our top five most anticipated films of the year. We'll also get Josh's Sundance recap and return to our Luis Buñuel marathon with Diary of a Chambermaid. What's your most anticipated film of 2017? Leave us a short voicemail, and we may play it on next week's show. The number to call, 312-264-0744. Find that number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
so you've already proven you're smarter than me. You picked up on the arrival reveal about 3/4 of the way through, maybe?
Yeah, or
basically before the end credits.
I did beat you there, which isn't to say that I perfectly tapped into everything that I think the movie, now in retrospect, was trying to do. So, yeah, I'm not sure exactly where you want to start. I can definitely lay out for you what I think is happening in the film and what's been corroborated by a couple things I've read. And I can tell you what I also didn't latch on to at all when I saw it.
Okay.
And I'm still trying to make sense of.
Well, let me ask you a question. So, basically, this is spoiler talk. Alert, alert.
Yes.
It is revealed that what we presumably thought were flashbacks involving this daughter she has who gets sick and we see dies, and that's very early on in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Those are flash forwards.
Yes.
They're visions of what will happen to her in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're in agreement on that. My question is she aware – when does she experience those, or are we only experiencing those?
Okay. I think I have an answer.
Okay.
I think, because I've thought about this a lot, and now I really want to rewatch the whole film.
Yeah, so do
I. With the knowledge. I think anybody would.
And let me preface this. Like, my not getting it,
yeah.
I'm putting on myself, not on the film. Like, this isn't a criticism
for
me. Yeah.
Yeah, so. I do think the way I was going to put it is, because I'm not here to make you or anyone else or me be put on the defensive, which is easy to have happen when you talk about what you got and didn't get.
Right.
I do think the movie, especially in retrospect, where you've had time to really ponder it, is deceptively simple. Like, I don't think it's nearly the mind bender that Enemy is or most David Lynch films are. Like, there's just many films that are way more complex than this film is.
It is trying to function. Enemy is not as clear in terms of what it's about,
right?
But it functions similarly. So Villeneuve clearly likes this sort of structure.
I think he does. Yes,
yeah.
Definitely. The nonlinear thing is very important to him.
But anyways, I distract you. Go back to the question of when she's experiencing.
Here's what I think happens.
Okay.
I think that it works on the one level of just being purely about the audience for the first half of the film or so, because the only flashbacks that occur are at the beginning of the film. Again, this is what I want to verify, but hear me out.
Flash forwards, you mean?
Though. Well, yes, but
okay.
We perceive them as flashbacks.
Got it.
Because we... Two things. One, we come from a culture that perceives time and we take in events linearly,
right,
in sequence. And we are used to things moving from left to right.
Yep.
And we see these things that through the course of movie history have been presented as flashbacks. So we immediately believe that these are flashbacks.
We've been trained.
At some point in the movie, she starts to have visions again that are in sync with those what we perceive as flashbacks earlier in the film,
mm-hmm.
Things that seem to be from the past about her daughter dying. But they don't start until she is some way into the learning process of the language that she has been interfacing with the aliens,
right,
on. So they start up at some point. So at that point, she is. We don't know how she's perceiving because she doesn't tell us. We simply see,
right,
her having these moments where she seems to be very flustered by a vision or something or a memory. We don't know, obviously, at that time. We know later that they're not. Well, they are memories, actually, because that's the whole point of the film, is that the past, present, and the future are all actually intertwined as one
If your mind's working this
way. If your mind's working the same way as the aliens. So it doesn't start until she's learned the language.
So her experience of,
yes,
learning the language is what gives her the ability to do this, rewires
her. Okay. And that's the thing that I felt like an idiot that I didn't totally catch up on. And I think this goes back to being wired a certain way as a moviegoer, where because I so strongly was convinced that those were flashbacks, not because Villeneuve necessarily really paints them that way, just because it's easy for us to fall into that default mode,
mm-hmm,
and think that that's what they are. We perceive them to be that. And so when she's having these visions or whatever they are, I wasn't tapping into the fact, even though Jeremy Renner's character literally says it. He says at one point, oh, I've been reading about this theory,
right,
where if you start to learn a new language, it can kind of rewire your brain. I mean, they spell it out for you at that point. But I was so convinced that what was really going on was somehow Amy Adams was imbued with some kind of gift. Because she had gone through this tremendous suffering, mm-hmm. and maybe just because of her heightened intellect and her interfacing with the aliens, something was happening in her where she was imbued with a gift that was being drawn out of her by the process with the aliens. And this isn't something anybody else could have ever picked up on. It's just something she's experiencing. I think what we come to learn by the end of the film is when we see in these now flash forwards that she writes a book about this language, the notion is actually that anybody, in theory, could learn this language, and that, in fact, the aliens are trying to give a gift to humanity.
No, they say that.
They say that. They're giving a gift to humanity of everybody, in a way, should be rewired to view time as one thing. Now, my question for you, the thing that really the movie has me thinking about, and I think in a good way, is how is that a gift? Beyond the fact that the movie lays it out as a gift the aliens are giving us because they say it's a gift. And you could argue that there's a certain element of a gift, of a good thing in a person having the perspective that even though the thing I'm about to embark on, I know is going to ultimately bring me tremendous pain and misery, I can recognize that it's worth the journey. And there are going to be so many other happy moments that I wouldn't have otherwise. It's worth it to go through the suffering to have the happiness. You could say that's a gift. But at the same time, other than potentially saving humanity, I think that's what's going on here too. I think the implication is that they say at one point that the humans helped them in like 3,000 years.
Right.
And the
that's
only way the
motivation.
Humans, the only way the humans, beyond them being able to speak their language, the only way that they'll be able to be helped is if the humans are still around.
Right.
And they're only going to still be around if they all work together and if they save the planet in some way or another. And you're given that perspective if, for example, if you were someone who is, let's say, a climate change denier, and all of a sudden your brain is rewired to start to perceive the future,
right,
you might come to have a completely different take on the future of your planet and you would change your ways. So, but all that said, Josh, my question is that really just for you, would you want to be in Amy Adams' shoes where you now live your every day where the past, the present, and the future all feel like one thing to
you? Yeah, and you know the, all the pain that you're going to to receive. No, of course not. I mean, I think there's a very practical reason, plot reason, why it's portrayed as a gift, and that's that she can then prevent the world war that's about to happen. You know,
right.
So that's the
but
reason.
But they want everybody to have the gift. The aliens seem to want everyone to have the
gift. Well, that ties into them saying so that they can, you know, humanity can help later.
And that's why she writes the book.
Right. To your question, though, I think why people are responding to this emotionally, and this is not an emotional response I had at all, so I feel this is another way I feel left out of this film, is because I appreciate it overall and, you know, like so many things about it, but did not have this overwhelming emotional response people are having. I think it's because they clued into this earlier, started to think more about the possibility of this ability before I did, and then start to see parallels with, well, this is how we live anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know the details, but it makes stark for us that no matter what is ahead, it's not all roses and sunshine.
And we don't
for
have
anyone.
A choice.
And we don't have a choice either. So all we're spared really are the details.
Yes.
And so there's something very universally comforting is maybe not the word, but consoling in that this is the human experience.
Yes. I agree with
that. And so in that way, I can really see how this is resonating for people. I also very much have sensed a divide just in the timing of seeing this. On the show, we reviewed it. Michael and I had seen it Monday night
before the
election Tuesday.
Right.
And obviously had no lens of the results to view this through. And the vast majority of the responses I've seen, I don't know if you read it this way, but have been perfectly through that lens.
I think it's undeniable.
Here's a movie of world unity.
Yeah.
And you know, it feels so good right now.
It would have fit perfectly with our top five movies that console and restore hope. And I wanted to see Arrival before that list just because based on little nuggets I was picking up on, I thought, well, this might be a contender.
And that's a really fascinating question too. I don't think it makes it a better movie or a worse movie, but it certainly has given Arrival more esteem than if it had come out, say, in June. So, how do we, how do you weigh something like
but,
that?
I mean,
you know, the day the Earth stood still is the same message. It's the same exact message, right? And an excellent sci-fi film, perhaps a superior one. If that had come out 2 days before something like this current election, you know, it would be seen through that lens too.
It's heightened, but the message of Arrival ultimately is also universal and timeless, unfortunately, about the human condition and about our inability to do those things, to work together.
You can't hold it against the film.
No, I don't think you can. I
kind of fascinating.
I think actually that does heighten the experience, and I think that's a good thing. Now, I do want to say this because we shared an experience in that, and I was talking to Sam about this, and I hope he doesn't mind me sharing this, but he told me he had seen it, and while he said it wasn't the emotional experience at all that the movie Interstellar was, kind of similar movies, you know.
Yeah,
and,
very
and
much so.
I can see the connection there, and I'm with him on that. We had a similar love for that film and a strong emotional reaction to it. He said it wasn't the same, but Arrival made him tear up a couple times. So I sat through the whole film, and I was provoked intellectually.
Yeah.
But I was so provoked intellectually that I never did tap into the emotion of it. And this is a movie about a mom watching her daughter die of cancer. Like, that's
okay,
a huge part of the film.
Don't you usually...
And I'm very susceptible to that kind of film.
Okay, or do you recoil? Because
I'm
go either way,
it.
Where it's like, oh, you're going
to
use this? You better make it work.
Well, that's a good point, because I will admit that as we got into it, I started thinking about Gravity, and I started thinking about all the movies that are driven by, sci-fi or otherwise, that are driven by a dead kid.
Yeah.
And yes, sometimes, yes, I'm susceptible to it because I think it's done right a lot of times, but you're right. Sometimes it feels really manipulative, and I think I was standing back. Now then, the twist here, the reveal, I think justifies it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And
but,
Adam's performance, the way that
yes.
she makes it, you know, she mines truths out of cliches.
Agreed. But even when at the end of the film, I'd put it all together and I recognize what she was sacrificing, and we can say it's the human condition and what choice does she have, but she actually does have a choice to make. She could choose not to go through all that future suffering. I think, I mean, that's very clear. Like the moment where this is the closest I got to an emotional reaction, but I'm just saying it didn't hit me. To put in perspective, and it's very hard to describe to someone what an emotional reaction feels like, but I got a little choked up, if you will, two different points in Moana. I got choked up at two different points within the same 2-minute span in The Edge of 17 at the end of that film. Just little moments, gestures where moments are revealed for the characters, where they have a reversal. They were profoundly moving. There's a lot of profound things going on in Arrival, but the closest one for me is when she says to him, "I forgot how good it felt to be touched by you." She says that to him when she hugs him. Now, she's hugging him when the whole alien thing has ended, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we think that that's the end of the story, but it's really the beginning of the story.
Right.
They then get married and have a child and do these things. So that moment where she's now experienced life having lost him as a husband and about to gain him as a husband. That moment where she says, "I forgot how good it felt to be touched," like that could have been really emotional, but I didn't feel it in the moment. I thought about it afterwards and felt, oh, that's kind of profound and deep.
I think
it didn't hit me.
It was probably the same because I was more intellectually processing what that meant than feeling it.
Yeah, I was. I'm intrigued by people like Sam and others who say, no, it really got him. But then again, I definitely don't mind a movie that has me still thinking about it days afterward and wanting to talk about it here like this. Like, I think that's great. So yeah, Arrival. There you go. Spoiler talk. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.